This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
Good to have you all here. This evening I'd like to talk about resilience, keeping the lilt in your step. These days, everybody seems to be talking about resilience. It's something we all want. We talk about it in education, where some claim that everybody's a winner and that everyone should get a prize. We talk about resilience even when doing mathematics and physics. People's concerns with global warming and climate change are about questioning the resilience of the earth. We talk about resilient communities in aid work in the face of crisis and war. In popular psychology, we've come to refer to resilience as people's mental or emotional capacity to thrive in the face of significant trauma. Resilience has become a buzzword that's frequently used in everyday life. We hear about it on the news with many workshops and conferences popping up all over on the topic. Thinking about an analogy can sometimes help with realizing what we're talking about. Have you ever participated in making a friendship loaf? Where you get a certain amount of cake dough from a friend, a starter, like the sourdough starter, and then you have to add some ingredients to the starter and bake the so-called friendship loaf. And part of the enjoyment of the outcome is having to share the residual starter with another friend, who passes on the remaining joy to another friend. Why do people make friendship loaves? We build friendship when we have something to share, a shared past or a common interest. And the residual starter of a friendship loaf can point us to the remnant of hope which makes us able to be resilient. The remnant that we receive from another beyond ourselves and can pass on to others as an expression of our love and kindness. Being able to be resilient somehow includes maintaining a residue, a remnant of energy, of meaning, of hope, so that we can press on with the adventures that life holds for us. But what exactly does it mean to be resilient? And how is it achievable? And in that part, I'm going to think of resourcefulness, robustness, and the remnant of hope. But let's start with, what is resilience? When you're resilient, you're flexible and are able to deal with pressure. You maintain a lilt in your step and a bounce back, even after misfortune and harsh times come your way. In resilience, you keep on going and persevere in the face of much adversity, distress, or challenge. UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, defines resilience as being able to anticipate, withstand, and bounce back from external pressures and shocks. So to be resilient is to adapt, to be pliable and bendable, to be able to recover quickly from difficult circumstances, to meet and overcome challenges. So to be resilient, you have to recoil, to somehow spring back into shape after being struck by unanticipated changes. When you decide not to give up, but instead to stick around and see how things will pan out and how you can participate in making them better, you're living out resilience. To be resilient is to work out how to cope. Come on in, there's more space down here. To be resilient is to work out how to cope in spite of setbacks and barriers and limited resources, and to cope regardless of feeling out of control amidst ambiguity. As we consider what resilience is, A visual image might help. A 19th century English painter called George Friedrich Watts, who was born in 1817 and died in 1904, and used to live down the road in Godalming, not far from here, called one of his most famous paintings, Hope. It was painted in 1886 and hangs in the Watts Gallery Trust. And he made a replica of it, which was painted in 1897, which hangs in the Tate Britain. At first glance, one could be inclined to call this painting despair. A dim canvas shows a bowed and stricken woman, a secretive figure cowering in the twilight over a broken lyre with only one remaining twisted string. And yet, although the hope may seem dim and delicate, it's actually immortal and indestructible. Let's think a bit more about this woman that Watts painted. Hunched and seemingly depleted, she sits on a rusty world. Watts chose to paint this world brown and not green, with no sign of growth. This woman looks afflicted and deprived. She seems smothered by her feelings of depression. She's sad and in a posture of not much hope. It's as if life is choking her. Even her clothes are smothering her as they stick to her. Perhaps she's lonely. I've seen a young student in her first year of university trying to study in a small rented room in a big city. So lonely and overwhelmed by the pressures of having to cope on her own that her brokenness went on for years. In her case, it didn't matter that there was a whole university full of students and streets full of people, because she didn't have relationship with them. And it somehow even hurt the relationship she did have with her friends and family. Or perhaps this woman has been deserted and betrayed. I've seen a young girl in a relationship having given her whole heart to a guy at too young an age. And when the relationship didn't last, the brokenness was like splintered glass all over the place. But especially the sense of isolation, the empty hours and the empty thoughts. Or perhaps this woman is bitter and resentful, stuck in a static mess. Maybe she's overwhelmed by all her fears and anxieties, and she just cannot look ahead because of it. Caught in an existential vacuum, she feels a void within herself. Everything is empty and meaningless. Swept away by apathy, she's depleted by a kind of emotional death taking over her, with her emotions blunt. Not being able to care anymore, with reality growing dimmer. Doomed to being a victim, insults just keep on piling up at her front door. And all she can do is let herself slide into decline, overcome by soul-destroying mental conflict. There seems to be nothing holding her back from slipping into a vague abyss. But what if she did sense her spirit piercing through the enveloping gloom? What if she did feel it transcend the hopeless, meaningless world? And from somewhere deep down could hear the victorious proclamation, yes, in answer to a question about the existence of an ultimate purpose. What if it really was possible? The woman in this Watts painting is clearly still clinging on to something. She's holding on for dear life. She hasn't fully folded, nor given up all hope. G.K. Chesterton wrote an interesting book on Watts, the artworks of Watts. And he said in there, in the center of the curved back of Watts' hope, we might almost think of ourselves as a bowed figure in the twilight, holding to her breast something damaged but undestroyed. Though Watts calls this tremendous reality hope, we may call it other things. Call it faith. Call it vitality. Call it a will to live. Call it the immortality of man. The woman is clinging onto a lyre, but it's an unusual lyre. Most lyres have at least 4 strings, if not 7 or 10. But this lyre has only 1 string left. Why does Watts choose to paint her clinging only onto 1 string? And even though this lyre only has 1 string, the lyre can still sing. G.K. Chesterton depicts this string as always stretched to snapping, and yet never snaps. The queerest and most delicate thing in us, the most fragile, the most fantastic, is in truth the backbone and indestructible. Faith is the perpetually defeated thing which survives all its conquerors. Notice that this string is external to the woman. It's not inside her. It's not her own inner strength that gives her the ability to sing. And have you noticed another element, even further from her, that could draw her to hope? The string of the lyre is in tension with the star. Do you see it popping out at the top there? It's as if the presence of the star above her makes us realize that this figure is trying to bring us nearer to something which is not just a symbol, but the reality behind the symbol. And this star reminds me of The Lord of the Rings, where J.R.R. Tolkien in The Return of the King describes Sam seeing such a star too. And Jane helped me get this quote. There, peeping among the cloud rack above a dark tower high up in the mountains, Sam saw a white star twinkle for a while. The beauty of it smote his heart as he looked up out of the forsaken land, and hope returned to him. For like a shaft, clear and cold, the thought pierced him that in the end, the shadow was only a small and passing thing. There was light and high beauty forever beyond its reach. Clinging onto the one string, lyre string, this woman struggles to hear the faint music as she sits in sadness and disarray, forlorn. The description of this painting in the Tate Britain is, she bends her head to listen to the faint music, but her efforts appear forlorn. The overall atmosphere is one of sadness and desolation rather than hope. The picture sense of melancholy is enhanced by the soft brushwork and translucent mists that envelop the floating globe. And yet the presence of the star above her, especially in the version in the Watts gallery, denotes that there can be more to the story. Watts portrays this woman as blindfolded. But why does he do this? What could be behind this choice? The thought of being blindfolded would seem to depict that you cannot see. And lacking hope is about not being able to see ahead. And yet this is a picture, with its star shining in the distance above, about hope. It reminds me of the text of Hebrews 11 verse 1, which links having hope with faith. Faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. The bandaged head, denoting blindness, is perhaps not one only of despair, but of having the faith to put your hope in someone, somebody, beyond yourself, in the one whom you may not initially see, but who's truly there. Let's move on together and think about how we can be resilient. So many of us know what it feels like to feel stuck inside ourselves, as if all of life is a burden. We see ourselves often as a victim, as inferior, and we live from a place of betrayal, powerlessness, and ambivalence. And being in such a bind, we've often tried to believe those voices which has told us that we just need to pull ourselves up out of our mess by our own bootstraps. And we've tried to be happy from a humanistic perspective in our own inner strength. With the aid of positive psychology, we've attempted to emotionally determine our well-being, but to no avail. We've tried to embrace being more self-reliant in the hope of fulfilling the promise of resilience that our age of popular psychology has been teaching us. Maxine Harley, a popular psychologist of our day, describes how to develop our so-called mental grit as follows. She said, resilience and self-reliance, it's an inner state of knowing, so you can deal with what comes along in life, that you'll do your best to accomplish what you want and need to. It's trusting that you can rely on yourself. You can support yourself emotionally and physically. It's the energizing feeling of okayness, happiness, and confidence when faced with setbacks, disappointments, and failures in life. It's about not submitting to self-doubt and fear of failure. It's about the meaning you give to your life. But the problem is, if we're honest with ourselves, we know that the self-help psychology, in which we just need to choose to be happy, has only brought us so far and no further. And so the question is, how have so many of us in our society come to put our hope in such psychology? I think that such thinking has its roots in the philosophy called existentialism. Jean-Paul Sartre wrote in his booklet called Existentialism is a Humanism, describing existentialism, he asks, what is meant here by saying existence precedes essence, value? Man first, or human beings, first of all exist, encounters himself, surges up in the world, and defines himself afterward. If man, as the existentialist conceives him, is indefinable, it's because at first he's nothing. Only afterward will he be something, and he himself will have made what he will be. So the existentialists believe that we come into existence and then we create our essence. We create our sense of value by the choices we make. It's as if I choose, therefore I am. If we choose to be happy, then somehow we can expect we'll be happy. And this places a big emphasis on the choices we make because they later determine our further existence and our identity. However, the Christian view, I think, is the exact opposite to such an existentialist view. As a Christian, I believe that we were created by God, who had the design plan to instill value in us, and then he created us. And so our task in being human is to work out what the value is that he has already instilled in us. We just need to live out his value by the choices we make. And as a Christian, I believe that my source of energy, my inner strength, is actually rooted in God and how he made me to be. But in the existentialist view, I create myself, including my own inner strength and resilience. So as we try to understand resilience more, it might be helpful to consider some others who've survived horrendous hardships, such as the Holocaust, since it must have cost enormous resilience to endure it, as we've been reminded in the last 2 weeks in the news with the 70-year remembrance of the Holocaust. Viktor Frankl, a psychiatrist who wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning, analyzed some of his personal experiences in Auschwitz and other Nazi concentration camps during the Second World War. Bearing in mind what we just read about popular psychology and what they've been teaching us, it's interesting to note that Frankl realized that happiness cannot be pursued, it must ensue. Happiness is not just something we choose for ourselves, it's actually the result of something else. Even though Frankl's psychology is all about choosing a meaningful existence in life, he came to realize that our choices on our own cannot make us happy. Suffering is universal, and we all suffer, but it's how we cope with the suffering that matters. We need to recognize we have a choice to respond to a situation, that we have the freedom to choose our attitude in a given situation. It's interesting to note that another psychiatrist who survived the Holocaust, Edith Eger, wrote a memoir called The Choice, Even in Hell, Hope Can Flower. And in her autobiography, she said some of her experiences of the horrors of the concentration camp. She said, "When we feel we have no control over our circumstances, when we believe that nothing we can do can alleviate our suffering or improve our lives, we stop taking action on our own behalf because we believe there's no point." It seems as if what Eger is saying here is that if we lose the ability to respond to our situation, then we give up and we lose the resilience to live. Viktor Frankl explained something similar when he described some of his fellow inmates in the concentration camp, when he said, "Once lost, the will to live seldom returned." But considering the will to live is connected to meaning, which is really found in oneself, it's remarkable to note that Frankl still acknowledged that everything can be taken from a man but one thing: to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances. And here we're not talking about choosing happiness, the emotion, but our choice of the attitude, an act of the will, with which to respond to a situation, giving meaning. Somehow, a certain amount of choice does matter when it comes to survival and resilience. Certain choices increase our sense of meaning. Having a sense of humor can help us to be more resilient. Seeing the funny side of things can enable us not to take life too seriously and to be able to laugh at ourselves. It can help us to be self-reflective as well. Another choice that enhances our sense of meaning and resilience is finding beauty in broken places. Having the eyes to notice and see the beauty around us is only possible if we believe it's there, and if we believe that life is bigger than ourselves. And meaning comes when we manage to maintain a sense of dignity and respect in life by being thankful for the gifts that have been given to us. So gratitude enables us to embrace the enjoyment in life, since it's actually, to be thankful, you have to be thankful to someone. So it acknowledges the source of the giver of the gift. And life will feel more meaningful and resilient if we're willing to welcome creativity into our lives. Since by being creative, I believe we're actually emulating being created. Notice that all of these choices evolve around meaning, being derived from a relational interaction in some way. But what if we don't feel any of these things? What if life just doesn't feel meaningful? The postmodern philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche once said, "He who has a why to live for can bear almost any how." And even though Nietzsche was a nihilist, he did understand that the why question seems to answer the question of meaning and purpose. But which why question will get us out of the abyss of having life feeling meaningless, stuck, and filled with shame? Let's have a look at another of some of the paintings of G.F. Watts in the hope of answering this. We'll look at a series of three paintings on Eve, and I'll go through them separately too, but it's nice to see them all together. The first one is She Shall Be Called Woman, and that was painted in 1875. And then a replica of it can be found in the Tate Britain in 1880. By the way, these three are all together in the Watts Gallery in Compton and Godalming. And then you have Eve Tempted from 1868, and he did an Eve Repentant in the same year in 1868. These three paintings are all similar in size. They're about 2.5 meters tall and 1.15 meters wide. They're large and robust paintings, and they clearly are making a statement. Although they were painted at different times, their similarity in size and theme allows them to kind of form a series. The central painting, She Shall Be Called Woman, is like an announcement. The posture of the woman, with her left hand facing upward and her head looking upward, and the beams of light from above streaming downwards towards her, make her presence appear to be a kind of declaration of her existence. She was made by the source external to herself. Ta-da, here she is. I get that feeling when I stand underneath that painting. It's as if Eve is in a pure state of being here. She's ready to accept a situation created by God. But then we have the next painting called Eve Tempted on the left. Nestling her head in the bushes, with her left hand giving pressure, she pushes herself away from having to face things. Her right hand is ready to grab whatever she wants, and her face avoids confronting any truth. She's open to fooling herself, denying any opposition, because she's not willing to admit that she's in the wrong. She's taken control. Her head is engulfed in her harmful choices. Notice the strong muscle in her left shoulder, showing that she's going to do it anyway. She's going to do it her way, whatever the cost. And then the painting on the right, as odd as it seems, it's called Eve Repentant. Her defiance is caught up with her. Her head no longer stands headstrong. Her hands are above her head, covering her face. And with her head hanging low, she cowers in shame. The why question seems to have caught up with her. Why did I do this? Yes, we stand before a choice in life, but the choice is actually about facing who we are when we feel shame, stuck and ashamed. To be resilient, we need to face our shame. Shame shuts us down. It prevents us from receiving and giving. Shame causes distance. But we have to see our need for our help amidst the shame. I believe resilience comes through facing our weakness and our need and working through our shame. Resilience comes through trusting that redemption and restoration is possible. Resilience relies on the hope that change is possible. Resilience relies on the source of strength that comes from outside of ourselves to achieve the courage, the change. The strength comes from God's grace, which has its roots in His love. We're given the choice to put off your old self, which is being corrupted by its deceitful desires, and to put on the new self, created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness, expressed in Ephesians 4, verse 22 to 24. The choice we have is to accept God's redemptive power, to be forgiven when we've sinned, have gone astray, and feel shame. We have the choice to return to who God created and longs for us to be. Like the painting in the middle, "She shall be called woman," announcing that our strength comes from above, from God. Our forgiveness comes from God, and not from the inner strength of our own existential choices. For in contrast to the painting on either side, it's as if Watt's center painting echoes the words of Eugene Peterson, who wrote The Message, in his book, A Long Obedience in the Same Direction. He said, "Joy cannot be commanded, purchased, or arranged. But there is something we can do. We can decide to live in response to the abundance of God and not under the dictatorship of our own poor needs. We can decide to live in the environment of a living God and not on our own dying selves. We can decide to center ourselves in the God who generously gives and not in our own egos which greedily grab." And when we make such a choice, we can be resilient. We can find ourselves filled with joy and be truly happy. Let's move on and think a bit about resourcefulness with regards to resilience. Resilience, you see, comes through our reliance on God, I believe. We will be resilient when we remember to put our trust in God and rely on Him rather than in ourselves, in our own inner strength. We need to remember the times when God graciously redeemed us, when we've gotten ourselves stuck in our own shame. Not only can we choose our attitude in a situation, as Viktor Frankl reminded us, but we can also choose to remember those stories of God's redemption for us. When we forget those moments in which we have experienced grace from God, betrayal and loss steal our faith. If we want to grow in our faith and in our resilience, we need to be open to listening to His story, to our own stories, to explore the meaning that God has woven into them, and become aware of those moments which were actually a rich deposit of God's presence in our lives. Being made in the image of God, the more such choices we make, the more our sense of being human will be enhanced. For before we were ever told that God made us in His image, we were told something very significant about who God is. In Genesis 1, in the beginning of the Bible, we see that God chose to make the earth, light from dark, day from night, and it was good. He chose to make water and earth, and it was good. He chose, and it was good. And so for us to be made in His image, we need to make choices too. The question is actually, resilience because of what or from what? To be resilient, we have to be resourceful. And that means honoring the true resource of our energies. Is it God who graciously gives me the strength in my times of need? Or am I the sole source of my inner strength? Robustness with regards to resilience. Resilience is not just about sucking it up and trying harder. There has to be more reason for us to be able to bounce back and be robust. Self-reliance doesn't help us with our doubts and our fears. Nor is our despair and loneliness eased by just pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps. Dan Allender, in his book called The Healing Path, reminds us that the counterpart to despair, doubt, and relational isolation and detachment doesn't just happen because we focus and rely on ourselves. He reminds us that faith, hope, and love enable us to rely on God so that we can be resilient. For the opposite of despair is hope. The opposite of doubt is faith. And the opposite of detachment is love. It's God who makes us robust. And so we can love because God first loved us. We have faith because of God's faithfulness to us. And we have hope based on God's promises to us. Our resilience will be robust if we're anchored in God. We love only because we have been loved. And God gives each of us the memory of at least one face that can have offered us a surprising kindness and an inexplicable grace. The powerful weight of grace is so great that even an ounce of kindness can challenge a ton of neglect and shame. The haunting, comforting memory of being loved is like the star in the east that guides us forward in our journey of life, just as the star in Watt's painting called Hope pointed to. Love that is remembered draws us to a love that will one day be fully restored. We lose hope when we stop remembering and telling stories that arouse a longing and an anticipation that there's a purpose in life, that we have a calling to contribute meaningfully to the bigger story of God's redeeming purposes. Resilience is fed by our recognizing that we have a sense of purpose and calling which is tied to the future. Hope is the quiet, incessant call to dream for the future. Faith and hope are actually inseparably linked, as we saw earlier in the Hebrews 11 verse 1 text. If we have faith, then we will have hope. But if we don't have faith, then we're likely not to anticipate the future and not to have hope. And we will struggle to be resilient. I believe that it's only through the lens of faith that suffering can be put into perspective. Our sense of hope grows when we see with the eyes of faith that we can anticipate that what is not yet now will one day be. And we expect that what is now will one day be even better. As Dan Allender says, how does hope grow? It grows in the soil of daily faithfulness as we live for something bigger than ourselves. Hope is a muscle that must be nourished and exercised daily to grow. It's seeing the future from the redemption of the past and then setting out toward what God has called us to become and to do. Hope grows as risk invites us to struggle with God. Hope cries to God in despair and protest. So our robustness is based on whether we can embrace hope. Hope frees us to live for God's purposes. Hope compels us to live for the future by pouring ourselves out as offerings to God in our relationship with those around us. Just as God restores faith and hope, he redeems shame and births love. Hope draws us to a greater risk and perseverance. Hope strains with eager anticipation to see what may be coming on the horizon. To dream of God's coming redemption is to struggle and keep hope burning in the midst of unexplained suffering. The eyes of hope see the shining residual glory in every sinner, every broken person, and the greater glory of what will one day be revealed through their existence. As Isaiah 40 verse 31 says, those who wait on the Lord will renew their strength. One of my favorite parts in one of Sally Lloyd-Jones' books, Thoughts to Make Your Heart Sing, is this one. What does a rocket need to lift off and go zooming into outer space? It needs a launch pad. Do you know what God's launch pad in our lives, from which he can do anything? Is it great faith? Our perfect record? Incredible courage? No. It's our great weakness. God's power comes to us in our littleness, in our brokenness, in our not knowing, in our not being able. And when God's power meets our weakness, lift off. As 2 Corinthians 12 verse 9 says, my grace is sufficient for you. My power is made in your weakness. So if we recognize our need because of our weakness, we can be content with whatever circumstances we find ourselves in. Paul in Philippians 4 verse 11 and 12 calls us to be content in all circumstances. And contentment comes, I think, from being fulfilled and thankful and satisfied because our strength comes from the Lord. Being content sustains our sense of resilience. We can only truly be content, in Paul's terms, if we have joy in the Lord, and a joy that has its resources outside of ourselves, a joy that has its hope in the redemption of Christ. And then the last one, the remnant of hope when I long for resilience. We can look ahead not having a specific plan, a map, or even a clear structure of what is next. But we can have a whisper of the story that reminds us that it's truly possible to see the goodness of God again in the land of the living. The whisper is the voice of God's Spirit, reminding us of the cross and our personal moments of exodus amidst the struggles of life, those moments where God clearly saves us from trouble we can't or wouldn't have avoided ourselves. The whisper is also our own voice that resonates with the voice of the Spirit, calling our memories to the fore, seeing the themes of redemption over and over again in our lives. God reminds us as we replay the stories so that we can move into the future with the confidence that God is good. We find resilience in taking the remnant in salvation history, the remnant of the Jewish people from which Christ would be born, and linking it to the concept of the remnant of hope that is there for each one of us personally. Hope focuses not only on our circumstances, but on Christ's coming and the redemption of our character. Hope clings onto that one string of the lyre in Watts's painting, Hope, knowing that we can rely on the truth of the promise that God is there, that He cares, that He's faithful and good. It's when our hope is centered on the coming redemption through Christ that we can hold on to His future glory. In the Old Testament of the Bible, we read of the story of Joseph's struggles. He was tormented by the rejection of his brothers, sold off as a slave to strangers, unfairly blamed for pursuing Potiphar's wife, and ending up in prison. He wondered why God had allowed him to be taken to such a faraway country. Here we see a man who had God working in his heart. Through going over and over his own story, sitting there in prison, I imagine, he hears the whisper of God's hand in it all, so that he can say to his family when later they're starving, desperate and hopeless, in Genesis 45, verse 7 and 8, God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth, to save your lives by a great deliverance. Joseph's faith in God, that he was where God wanted him to be, where all hope lies, can be heard when he could admit to his brothers in Genesis 50, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good." So you see, Joseph's resilience lay in the fact that despite his struggle with pain and brokenness of his story, he could see the remnant of hope, hear the sound from that one string of the lyre singing with him all along. Even though we have pain and brokenness in life, there is hope because God is good. The remnant of God's people, which is referred to in Isaiah 11, out of whom Christ was to be born, the remnant of God's people were promised a message of resilience, of hope through Christ. Paul makes reference to Isaiah in Romans 15 when he describes that promise of resilience and true joy for God's people. We can put our trust in this God of hope because of the work of the Holy Spirit in us, in whom our strength lies. I'd like to close by reading Romans 15, verse 12 and 13. The root of Jesse will spring up, one who will arise to rule over the nations. The Gentiles will hope in him. May the God of hope fill you all with joy and peace as you trust in him, so that you may overflow with hope by the power of